Welcome to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas, brought to you by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest, I'm delighted to say, is Dr. Larry Arn. Larry Arn is the 12th president of Hillsdale College. Larry and I have a conversation about several of today's most controversial issues involving college campuses, including free speech and its limits, the impact of government funding, and admissions of foreign students into U.S. universities. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Larry Arn, welcome. Thank you for joining.
My pleasure. Scott Atlas, warrior scholar.
Well, thank you. there's so many things happening, and you're the perfect person to talk about many of these things, particularly what's happening on college campuses, the freedoms of speech, and everything else that are always in jeopardy, really. We can never take it for granted. And I want to explore a lot of that, as well as how you have devised your own independence of Hillsdale College over the time that you've been there, because I think it's a very unique and story and perhaps a model for making sure that, our students not just learn, but you're free from whoever is in power in government. And I think this is a critical part of your own vision. So, first, I want to start out by talking about the main freedom that we take for granted, which is freedom of speech, because this is, it's controversial, which to me sort of is shocking. It shouldn't be controversial, really. But when controversial things are said, people all of a sudden want to impose their own rules on freedom of speech. But on campus particularly, let's talk about how you have dealt with and what your general philosophy is on campus freedom of speech, because it's a different environment. And then we'll talk about specific issues.
Freedom of speech is, first of all, the First Amendment is the First Amendment. And that means it concerns the things that only human beings do and concern the human soul. Praying, writing, speaking, asking, getting together. And so there's a reason why it's first. The Second Amendment, by the way, concerns the body, the protection of the body. That's about gun rights. But the first thing is the soul. Colleges are about the soul. And so we need to talk. We human beings have this unique gift. We can talk. That's what's different about us. Reason and speech are the same thing in the Greek language. So in a college, what do you need to do? Well, the only qualification on freedom of speech is the purpose of the institution. And so we have an old speech code here, a long time before there was much controversy about it. You can say what you want to. You must say it in a civil and academic manner. Academic, because if you talk trash and stupidity, somebody's going to point it out. That's what colleges are for. Civil, you have to be friends. You have to talk. And that means this thing that's happening all over, especially the most elite campuses, Dirty Jew. I was in Cambridge 2 weeks ago. I discovered that there's an underground, an academic underground in Oxford and Cambridge and London, and they want those colleges to remain colleges. And somebody said to me, how are Jews treated at Hillsdale College? It's a Christian college, never required a faith statement to attend. And I said, just like everybody else. Then that person said to my wife, if I walk across campus on Cambridge University and wear my yarmulke, people say, free Palestine. As I pass them on the street, I get that multiple times anytime I do it. Well, first of all, that means you can't be friends with that young man. He didn't do anything. He's probably never been to Palestine. But he's a member of the community, except he's not treated that way. So that's why civil. You, in order to share your, like one of the things that gets to happen in a college is you get to make a fool of yourself. You know, freshman trying to explain Aristotle or your world, the body, the physical processes in it, right? Well, they don't know much about that. And so whatever they're going to say is going to be a lot better later. You need to be free to do that. And that means you have to trust the people around you. So the point is, those are the standards. And more important than that, you talked about the independence of the college. That's old. That started in 1960 when the federal government started giving money to colleges. We never did. The blessing that comes from that is everyone here is a volunteer. That is to say, you know what the college is before you come. If you want to teach or work or study here, this is what we do. We didn't start it. It has these old purposes. So you agree to participate in these purposes, which are very high and eternal things even. And so we have a common project here. We're all supposed to make this work. And we do it by learning, which involves disagreeing all the time. You know, I always say diversity of opinion is inevitable because every kid and every professor changes their mind about something every day, every time they learn something. And that means you have to compare those disagreements. And what you're looking for is the truth. You have to be prepared to alter your opinion constantly.
Sure. I mean, that's the point of a free exchange of ideas. We can't learn critical thinking, and which is really, to me, what you're trying to teach people in school, without hearing the differing views. I mean, this is sort of obvious.
Yeah. And one of the things that's criticized in critical thinking is your own thinking.
And right. So exactly.
If you insist upon it, you know, you're a dirty Jew, river to the sea, right? That's you've written them out of the academic community. You've, in fact, even written them off the existence, the face of the earth with that phrase. And if you do that, you can't learn with them. And so it's just, they've just completely lost their way. And
now, but speaking of those kinds of words, you know, I'm not a believer that words themselves should be prohibited, essentially, no matter what they say. I would rather err on the side of letting people say what they want. But there is, and so this concept of hate speech, I don't like it. No one likes it, but I'm not sure that it should be literally prohibited. I in fact don't think the hate speech should be prohibited. It, like you sort of implied, it exposes your own ignorance. And you know, okay, I mean, it's repulsive, but I'm not sure that hate speech or speech that is negative, you know, we learn from hearing it. I think part of what you need to do when you're in college, many people, it's the first time they're living outside of their home, is learn how to grow up and deal with speech that you don't agree with. But when speech becomes violent protest or blocking pathways on to school buildings or taking over buildings, this is beyond freedom of expression to me. Have you dealt with this kind of issue on your own campus? And even if you haven't, what is there a policy about this sort of thing? And what I'm trying to get at, what goes beyond the limit of free speech?
Well, you have to make an adjustment that's difficult to make because our college works differently from just about every other. That is to say, everybody here is a volunteer. And that means, yeah, I don't have that. In 1967, one of my predecessors was written up in Time magazine because they were shutting down college campuses all over the country. And he sent a letter to the entire student body and said, the college has a work to do, which is to hold class. And if you intend to disrupt that, you will be expelled. And so why don't you write me and tell me, and I'll help you find someplace else to go to college. And that got in Time magazine, you know, a big coup, right? Well, that's the right spirit. And, you know, as a rule, you don't want rules.
That's right. You know, codes of conduct and free speech, yeah. Academic freedom statements. I always find these things, especially, you know, I always say electronic statements about academic freedom are worth the paper they're written on.
Yeah, I get, you know, we don't have many problems here. We have them. They're young, right? They're stupid. And, you know, growing up.
And, you're talking about students, not faculty.
Both. Yeah, all of us. Me too. And so we all make mistakes, sure. Right? And the right solution, like I had a boy one time, like if their mothers complain to me that they don't call, I will say, I'll see the kid and I'll say, call your mom. And then I had a boy, big libertarian boy. He's a very successful businessman now. Name was Chandler, played first base on the baseball team. And he'd absorbed all his Hayek and Mises, you know, and he says, are you saying that you have the authority to tell me to call my mother? And I said, no, I'm saying, call your mother. And he did, you know. But in other words, you know, like if some kid says something hateful to some other kid, I will say, that wasn't very nice. Don't do that anymore. And, you know, in other words, I don't really have a rule. Like that speech code thing, the only reason anybody here around here knows what it is because we get asked all the time, what's your speech code, right?
Right.
I had to look it up to find out what it was. And that thing, you know, what you were talking about, you were giving illustrations of where speech goes from, you know, into action, right? Certainly, it can't do that. But what about slander and libel?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you make bad rules from the hard cases. And so it's really better not to make the rule. It's better to establish in everybody. And in advance is very important, by the way. Like to come to Hillsdale College, you have to sign the honor code. And what it basically requires of you, we wrote it here ourselves in 2002, and I figured out the need for it because kids were always claiming we were doing something to them that we hadn't told them about. And 18-year-olds really don't like that, right? They're at the age of choosing, as you say, moving away from home for the first time. And it's a very delightful age, right? And it's fun for the college president because it's easy to make fun of them. But you know, you confront them with this thing. This is how we are going to behave here. You know, you want to do that? Because we can really do great if we act like that. We'll all learn from each other. But you got to be good. And one of my favorite sayings is the only rule that everybody can remember is be good. Mm-hmm. So if you have that intention and a commitment in advance of everybody in the community, then all of a sudden you don't need rules. When I came here, we had 150 pages of student rules. I've reduced them to 3/4 of 1 page, and it's only lawyers that those 17 rules still exist, because you get some legal protection if you say you can't do this in advance and somebody does it. But I try to get rid of some of them every year. And the reason is you don't need rules. Everybody knows what's good and what's not. And, you know, once in a while, didn't happen very often, but some kid does something bad enough to get in my office. And it's always the same conversation. I always say, now, what did you do? And they hang their head and tell me. And I say, was that a good thing to do? And they say, no. And I say, don't do that anymore. Now, in a world, Scott, because like your own career, right? You're a scholar and a doctor, and you're tops, big. Everything is a federal case. You know that old expression? Don't make a federal case out of it.
Sure.
The government is the prime funder of higher education, and everybody thinks about it like Congress, like it's a courtroom. Right. It isn't. It's a different kind of thing. And so to reduce it to all of that is destructive. And it's the reason we have nothing is so important as to decentralize just about everything in America. And especially education. Because then, you know, like you are, you know, I happen to have had very tense. I went through something very tense under your guidance. Let's say I risked arrest to keep our college open. And you were right there with me, helping me figure out if the kids were all going to get killed by COVID, because I thought it'd be embarrassing if I kept the college open and they all died.
Right.
Better if that doesn't happen, I thought. And you know, the flack you got for that and I got for that, it goes on to this day, right? It shouldn't be like that.
Right.
Because the only rule that I made about COVID, like, first of all, from you and Jay Bhattacharya and Martin Kulldorff and Daniel Halperin from North Carolina, I got myself the best education a layman can get in 2 months from you three, four guys, right? And you told me everything. It's amazing, beautiful, you know, really. And you know, you're authoritative, you know how to talk, and you know how to explain, you have mastery. Well, I didn't try to reproduce that. The rule that I made was simple. I said, the college is open. If you're afraid of this thing or think in your judgment you ought not to come, stay home. We'll pay you to work and we'll find a way for you to study. You don't have to come. You see? And that was the right thing.
Right.
And, you know, I had 200 some faculty members here. Six of them stayed home. One of them said to me, I'm very worried about your policy. And I always said the same thing. I said, yeah, me too. And they said, I said, but, you know, if you were, this particular woman is a biologist. And I said, look, you don't have to come. And she said, I'm worried about the others. And I said, okay, who has the station here to do that? And she paused. And I said, there are two people. One of them is each of them, and the other is I. And, you know, if you want to tell them they ought not to come, it's a free country, tell them. But they seem to be coming, don't they? Well, the country, the whole country, used to be administered that way. Tocqueville.
Yeah, I mean, that's freedom. That's essentially what you have in a free country. It's very simple.
Yeah. And this idea that this guru, you know, Anthony Fauci, I happen to know the vice president of those days, Mike Pence, and like him. And he called me up and said, how am I doing? And I said, get Anthony Fauci off the stage. And he said, I said, you're turning him into the Archangel Gabriel. And he said, who should I get? Deborah Birx. And I said, no. He said, you don't like her. I said, I don't know anything about her. Get a mixture. And then people will see that we're not in agreement about this among the experts. And then you can make the only kind of decision that's possible here, which is a practical decision.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you picked an expert and you're, you know, I mean, that's, I guess that wasn't a confidential conversation, but it just, you know, I studied Winston Churchill in 1902. When he was 27 years old, Winston Churchill wrote a letter to H.G. Wells. I cannot agree that a future society can be ruled by experts. Expert knowledge is narrow knowledge, and
exactly.
No one can be an expert on the range of things necessary to every serious practical decision. So we human beings are made to govern ourselves, and we shouldn't have so much government. They, you know, I said that I have three quarters of one page of student rules. If you take the federal student aid, that's 500 pages that only an expert can read. And so it's the wrong way. And like you, Scott, have been persecuted for things you say in places where you work and stood up to that just the way you would. You know, by the way, if you're working for me, I would never persecute you because I wouldn't want that fight. It got too tough. but the truth of the matter is they were just pretending that that university is a Congress and an executive branch and a court of law. And everybody's got to say the same thing. And that's just so mistaken.
Yeah. Right?
All you did is make an argument. And the truth is, the hard cases are hard for a reason. Like,
right.
I'll name a milder case. Let's say there's a, a class going on at Hillsdale College in Jewish studies. And we have some Jews here. I don't know how many. I don't care. But let's say there's 10 of them in there and 10 others. And let's say somebody's outside disrupting the class, chanting, "Dirty Jew, dirty Jew, dirty Jew, river to the sea," and they can't have class. You got to stop that, right?
Because that's an action that interferes with the actual activity.
Let's say that one of those Jewish students walking across this campus meets that every third person he encounters. Changes his experience. Mm-hmm. And messes up a lot of things. Now, how do you write a federal rule to stop that? I don't know, but I know how to stop it here. It never happened, but if it did, I'd just say, wait, cut that out. And they would, right? And if they said, you're saying I don't have the right to say whatever I want, I'd say, no, you just can't. Then cut that out, please. That's not nice. You know, and they would. And if it went on.
Yeah, I mean, this is like you say, these are very complicated issues. And I think it's different when the media amplifies things, when, you know, you have the sort of hyperbolic reaction to everything that happens. But part of the issue here, and it may not be true at Hillsdale, is that I think people feel that Americans' hard-earned money is taken by the federal government for taxes. And I always like to quote my British one of my many people I admire, which Margaret Thatcher, who basically said the government has no money, it's taxpayer money, as you know. Yeah. And, you know, this kind of taking taxpayer money to pay for the education, not just in loans, but in many, many other ways, as you know, including grants, et cetera. And some of them you have distanced yourself from with Hillsdale, the way it operates. But more than that, foreign-born students who come here as a privilege, and they're chanting in the anti-American, not just in, okay, again, my personal view, they can chant what they want. That's my own view. I don't know what anyone else thinks. But I don't think you can intimidate other students, block their way to school, take over buildings. Then you're beyond the line. And so here I want to shift a little bit into this idea that the federal government, meaning American taxpayers, are giving massive money to America's college campuses and universities. And of course, in one sense, there's nothing more important than educating our children. I mean, I think most people would say that. But then you get into what's being done with that money, and now we're bringing up the, quote, Harvard situation of the anti-Semitism on campus, and the Columbia University and all these things. So tell the audience what you've done at Hillsdale to free yourself up from reliance on federal government and therefore American taxpayer money, and how you fund your school, and what your thoughts are in the bigger world of where most universities do take massive money.
So first of all, there are two changes, not one. One of the changes is money, and the other is the way we govern. The money, I'll say a word about that, but the way we govern is different now. Now mm-hmm. It's bureaucratically. It's rules-based. You practice medicine, right? And there's lots of details to know about how to go about doing that, right? But what if, and there are through Medicare, I think, what if there were 150 pages of rules about how to treat that don't concern the disease or the health of the patient?
Mm-hmm.
They're procedures, right? That's bureaucracy. It proceeds by rules. And the rules change over time because every time a case comes up, they write a new rule. That's why we had 150 pages of student rules when I came to work here. And we were not particularly bureaucratically governed. We weren't taking any money from the government even back then. But every time some kid, you know, some boy would get caught standing outside the window of a woman's dorm, peeking in the room, talking to his girlfriend. We made a rule that you can't do that. And you know, that it's a rule, right? And the amount of the fine is named and all that stuff. And I just repealed all that. I said, you know, if somebody does that now, I just say, don't peek at the girls, you know? Because what these rules do is they empower the one who makes them, right? Because they're very complex. They're the only ones who can hope to know what they are. But there's so many now that nobody knows what they are. And just the understand, we have to get in our minds, that's a different thing in kind. It's not the same kind of thing as the old American government. It's illustrated in two ways. I was in the office of Senator Mike Lee from Utah the other day, who's a buddy of mine. And he's built a cabinet, and it's got three bays in it, and it's about 5 feet high. And each bay is a little wider than 11 by 14 sheet of paper. And all three bays, 4 feet high, are full of single sheets of paper. And they contain last year's addition to the United States Code. 1 year, right? Nobody can read that, right? That's a different kind of thing. The old kind of thing still prevails. The Congress of the United States, from its first year, 1792, has passed somewhere between 150 and 300 laws every year, up to and including last year. That process is still the same. Now there's a whole other process, different in kind. So the point is not just the money. It's the manner of giving and regulating it that's different. Now, the money is interesting, too, because the United States has four organic laws, and two of them were passed in 1787. One was the Constitution of the United States, and the other is the Northwest Ordinance. While those two, the same Congress that passed under the Articles of Confederation that passed the Northwest Ordinance, in the Northwest Ordinance, provided the first subsidy to colleges. And the way they gave it is beautiful. They owned the western land, which they didn't know how big it was in that year. They didn't find out until 1807 how big the continent was when Lewis and Clark came back. They took 1/64th of the western land in the Northwest Territory, and they gave it to the states as an endowment for education in each township, right? Enormous. There's never been a bigger subsidy to education. It was actually extended across the country. By the time it got to California, there were four sections of land devoted for that in California. You can go to the deeds of the land around Stanford, mm-hmm. and you'll be able to find the places. I know where the one in Hillsdale is. See? And there's only one regulation, and it's in the Northwest Ordinance proper. It says, religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall ever be encouraged. That's the non-bureaucratic way to support education. And examples are multiplying in America today because in most states now, there's a charter school law. And in the best states, the laws are very liberal. Organize a school, educate some kids. The main accountability is through the parents. Do a good job. You can have this money. You see, that's a return to the way to go about subsidizing education, which of course must be done because young people don't have any money. And so, right. In other words, it's the combination of those two things that is lethal.
But today you have billions of dollars being given of taxpayer money to colleges and universities, even many of whom have billions of dollars already that they do whatever they want with. And when you take money from someone, we know this in our personal lives, I'm very reluctant to, and in fact, I don't take a loan from a relative, for instance. I never did because I want independence because there's always strings attached. And what we see here is that we have federal taxpayer money, thinking through the lens of a taxpayer, of which I am, given to colleges and universities that are using it in ways that not just many of us don't approve of, but things like these diversity, equity, inclusion policies that are destructive, harmful, in my opinion, or a race-based admissions that are destructive and harmful and anti-American and racist, in my opinion. And then educating, giving scholarships to foreign students who are, you know, anti-American and bringing or inciting hostility on campuses. And I'm opposed to that. So, you know, there's this sort of ownership implication of taking someone else's money, and rightfully so in ways. So it's complicated. And so the sort of question here is, we have a president who's saying, okay, we're taking taxpayer money. President Trump is saying we're taking taxpayer money and we're giving it to these colleges and look what they're doing with it. We don't want to just give them carte blanche on these things, particularly for destructive, harmful, anti-American policies, or at least those that are deemed that for foreign students on visas, for example, for colleges like Harvard, who have a $50 billion endowment that they never use. It never goes down in value, never. And yet they keep taking massive money. So I sort of am getting at, you know, what do you do about that? I know, you know, it's a lot of schools need money because they are research universities. They get grants of, you know, we have 15 plus academic medical centers that are associated with universities that take over $500 million of taxpayer money every single year just from the NIH alone. It has nothing to do with the other subsidies. And I don't think Hillsdale would be in that category because that's not your mission. Yours is really more education. I'm not saying you don't do any research, but you know, what are your thoughts on that money issue? Because it's a reality, and now there's a reactive policy to that. And in fact, the president and the administration are being sued by some of our universities.
Oh, yeah. That's good. I think it's all delicious. So first of all, the logical principles, you've laid them out yourself in this conversation. The government doesn't have any money. It gets it from the taxpayers. And that means the money that funds all those research institutions existed before the government got its mitts on it. And that means they could be funded directly from the source. As a matter of fact,
from the taxpayer himself, you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, instead of through taxes, give them some dope. Americans are they are the only widespread charitable population on the face of the earth. Been that for 200 years.
Absolutely true. And we have a massive philanthropy culture that is simply non-existent, even in our European peer nations.
Yeah, I'm just in England. They don't, you know, they want to save Cambridge and Oxford and they want me to help them. And they admire very much that we are not prey to those things that are destroying the elite universities. And they think maybe we got quite a lot of money. I could be the rich American uncle. and we'll see about that. But we're not rich. You never know how rich somebody is till you know what their expenses are. But the point is, Harvard is from 1750, round number 60, something like that. The first big federal money to education started in about 1961, right? How did it live before that? Did Albert Einstein live on government grants? Everything that doesn't immediately produce a product requires subsidy from something that does, right? But those subsidies don't have to go through the government. You know, as a matter of fact, we've converted ourselves. The model, you know, like my wife is English and I studied Winston Churchill and I spent time there. So I know about that country, right? And here's something I noticed that's in the culture, and I noticed it from close observation of families. My wife's family are lawyers, old law firm, north of England, prominent people. But there are more prominent people, lords and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And in that part of the world, up in Lancashire, my wife's daddy was head of a certain rank of charity, and there were bigger ones, and that was for the Earl and the Baron, right? In other words, the Borgias hired Michelangelo. They were aristocrats, right? We've actually converted ourselves into something more like that. Now to do a big project, you've got to go to the people who've got the dough, and they're powerful people, and they're in Washington, D.C., something I've heard you complain about.
Mm-hmm.
The percentage of the support for academic research in the natural sciences comes from two places in Washington, D.C. One of our buddies is in charge of one of them now, so we like it rather better. Alas, he won't always be. Why don't you decentralize that?
Mm-hmm.
Why not? You know, there's Carnegie libraries all over the country, and nobody made him do that.
Right. I mean, I think we have, you're pointing out something which I always also like to point out, which is that, you know, it's the bigger question is, why is it that government is viewed as the answer, the solution, the problem solver, when they never do much right anyway? I mean, I think that's sort of undeniable, but maybe, everything I think is undeniable is always denied, so I'm sure I'm wrong.
That's right, yeah.
But, the government is not necessarily a solution, and I think this is part of the reason why there's this, what many say, arbitrary decrease in the so-called indirect costs of NIH grants, went because it's been abused, and there are places like in Scripps in California that has a 95% indirect cost add-on to the direct cost of research. And so now there's this move to make it, let's say it's 15%, which there is no right answer, but it'd be nice to at least have a budget for it. There's no budget for these indirect costs on grants, by the way. People don't even understand. It's just a blanket number, which is no required justification. But in any event, government isn't necessarily the only solution. We know it's never the only solution. It's certainly not usually the best solution. And I think this is what you're pointing out, is that there are ways, but it's difficult to put that horse back in the barn, or whatever the saying is. Because nobody wants to cut off receiving funding. Not many people do. And the funder has power with being the funder. So I think it's a very tricky situation. But my guess is that there is going to be, at least there is a new discussion on how much money is being given or appropriated to colleges and universities and research entities. This is a very important question.
I think the solution for Harvard is, they have $54 billion in endowment, and they spend 4% of it a year, and that number means $4 billion, that means $2.5 billion.
Mm-hmm.
That's also about what they get from the government. If you don't like what they're doing, don't give them the money. And that is an elegant and simple solution. And it would flow them onto their own resources. And they have a lot, right? I bet they could figure it out. And I gather that, I think one reads in the paper, I like to say, I don't understand the economics of Harvard, and I don't think Harvard does either.
Mm-hmm.
But I gather that the $2.2 billion federal money number, which is in the press now, that's against an $8.6 billion budget, and that's $8.6 billion spread over 25 or 30,000 people. They got quite a lot of money there, and they're spending a lot. And I bet that could all be done more efficiently. And
that's why the conversation has to be had. Just the visibility of the issue, I think it generates a discussion. I'm a little bit worried about, I am very worried about the fact that any government, elected or not, can simply decree who gets money and who doesn't. And that's why I think it's a bigger issue, of course, than Harvard. Harvard isn't really the issue, but they're what's provoking the discussion. And I think we really have to look at what is done. It goes into a bigger conversation. What is done with taxpayer money? Because some of this is really outrageous, scandalous. So it's not just Harvard. I'm sure you agree with that. And I think we need to have somebody who says, wait a second, why are we even giving these colleges and universities taxpayer money?
I watched a friend of mine has a nephew who spoke on college day at Harvard the day before commencement, where the kids have the ceremonies of their own. And so much about that was healthy. And I watched it because his uncle sent it to me.
Sure.
And asked me to watch it. So much of that was just like here. Fresh young kids having fun, making fun of the college president. They were pretty good at it. And at Harvard, by the way, they've got a wide variety of college presidents to make fun of. And they were having a party, right? And I just thought, what a disservice to those kids. Because they're smart, you know. Harvard, when I think of Harvard, I'm not angry. I'm sad. Because Harvard is still, in important respects, a very great place. Mm-hmm. And it has been the greatest and the first in America. The loss of it is a tragedy. They should straighten up, do a better job. Stop this stuff, you know, and they're subsidized to do it. And, you know, it's worth introducing as a historical fact, as in a fact in political thought. The ideas that have led to big government in America, and we have to get in our minds that big government in America is an innovation. It was never meant, right? And it really only dates to the 1960s, although the roots of it are in the 1880s. Well, the people who brought it first into certain universities, especially Columbia, Johns Hopkins, and Princeton. Woodrow Wilson, Frank Goodnow, John Dewey.
Mm-hmm.
And their friends, right? And their plan was to remake the university in order to remake the government, in order to remake the country. So it was always the plan to change them into what they've become. And to use that to change the rest of us, right? And that means it's a matter of self-defense to stop this.
Well, I think, again, it points out there's really nothing more important than what's going on with educating our children. Not that everyone even needs to go to college or should go to college, but this is all this big field that you're intimately involved with from the lower grade levels on up. What we really need to, we can't have this jewel of American society destroyed. And I'm very concerned, like you are, saddened by what is going on. I was saddened by what I saw at Stanford. This is just another part of that sort of exposure of some of these things. But we need to be aware of them before we can fix them. We've been very complacent, and it's easy to be when you have the greatest country in the world, the most prosperous society in the history of man, and then you turn around and you see, wait a second, we have serious problems here. Go ahead.
Those three guys that I named, in their academic writings, it's very plain that they mean a difference in kind. They're going to change everything. In their political writings, especially in Woodrow Wilson, it's all very normal and just a development on what we're already doing. So part of it, you know, this has taken 100 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is the frog in the warming pan.
Right.
But, you know,
exactly.
Gradual. And now, I mean, look, first of all, if we had $37 trillion more dollars, we'd be broke in the government. And it's not working, and we got urgent public needs like infrastructure, all kinds of things. and we not taking care of them. And China's got a bigger navy than we are and building about 16 times faster than we do. And so they're huge, major public needs that are unattended to, and we're broke, which means we're at the place now where we can't afford this anymore. And so that's why it might get changed.
Right. Well, you know, that's the pendulum has to swing so far before we get a wake-up call and swing it back. And I think, you know, we'll see. I'm quasi-optimistic, I would say, that we were woken up. I'm looking forward to more graduates of Hillsdale that are hopefully gonna come up with some great ideas and in a way really save the country. Because none of us who have children want to have the country passed on to our children in the state that it is on or in, really. And I'm very concerned with it, but I have to say, and as a sign off here, I am very delighted to have come to know so many great people in journalism, in the media, in a variety of fields, in government, who, once I know them, it comes out that, hey, they went to Hillsdale. I mean, it's quite eye-opening, and it's a great tribute to you, to the faculty that you've put together at Hillsdale, to the mission of Hillsdale and the vision of Hillsdale. It's just really something I never get to publicly say, but you've done an amazing job.
Well, I was in Oxford and Cambridge, as I said. And one night I gave a talk at a thing called the Canterbury Institute. They give scholarships for Americans to go to Oxford, and we win some of them. And there were 35 students in the room, and six of them were Hillsdale graduates getting D-fields in Oxford. And the most arresting thing of the night was when I saw those six, I knew them all, and we were friends. And we, in the reception, we stood around and talked about Hillsdale and how bad they miss it. And everybody else, students in Oxford and Cambridge, were staring at us saying, wow, it really is like that, isn't it? So
yes, it
Hillsdale
is.
College is kind of fun.
It is. All right, Larry. Well, I just it's always a pleasure to talk and hear what your thoughts are on these things. And I hope I get to have you on again. Thank you for coming.
You're a great man, Scott. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, check out his writings and his numerous interviews in the media. Check out Hillsdale's online courses and read Hillsdale's important Imprimis publication. Don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.